Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.
It's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance beneath the cover of October skies. You know the leaves on the trees.
What's up?
Are
what's up, everybody? Welcome aboard to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz. It's time for a friend of mine, a guy I got to finally sit down and meet from across the pond. Our friend, Dr. Bob Swarup from Candor Global, as well as the author of Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts. And Bob, or Dr. Bob, it was great to see you when you were in town. And what are you thinking here, my man? What's going on in this world?
God is great to see you too. I mean, I'll tell you, this world just gets crazy and crazier, right? If you think about it, you know, 9 months ago, if you had said that, you know, the major kind of Western powers in the world, you'd have, you know, Trump, Putin, some Brexiteer, and Marine Le Pen in charge of some major economies, everyone would think you were smoking weed or something. But of course now, come end of November, we've got Putin in charge of Russia, we've got Donald Trump in charge of the US, we've got Theresa May in charge of the UK, arguing for hard Brexit. We're three-quarters of the way there. In fact, all that's left now is to see what happens in France and Germany next year.
Well, and I'm sure, I mean, I don't think Merkel's going to win in her bid. What do you think? You'd be closer to that situation. I don't think she's going to win.
Well, Merkel's going to have some serious challenges. I mean, it's kind of ironic that Merkel's now suddenly become the face of liberal globalization, given how she wasn't seen as that a few years ago. Like, her challenge is that, you know, right now, AfD, Alternative für Deutschland, is polling probably about 15%. That means that they're going to get about 85 seats in the German parliament. And I think if they do that, the pressure will be very much on Merkel, because her own party and also this grand coalition that they've been basing everything on, I think that coalition then starts to fall apart, because at the very least, one or the other of the parties will want to try and move to grab some of the ground from AfD, because they can see the population's mood shifting.
And isn't the entire, I mean, aren't we almost having a global shift in sentiment, and isn't it getting like this is like the a prelude to potential? I mean, we already have some violence, but almost a internal wars in different countries. Because I think that the less fortunate are starting to have an uprising here, and they're getting pretty angry. What do you think about that?
No, I think there's a writer called Arundhati Roy, I think, who made a quote which she said the only thing worth globalizing is dissent. And I think that's what you're seeing. There's one thing that's global right now. It's society after society and country after country saying we've had enough, we want to change. And I don't think, by the way, it's unexpected either. You know, you and I have talked about this on the show plenty in the past about how politicians and policymakers just completely missed the shifts and the tensions in the social mood. And I think part of the problem is, you know, if you look at the globalization, I mean, it's been a great ride the last 50 years. But if you think about a politician responds to two things. They respond to voters, but that's usually more in election time. And they respond to external markets being, of course, financial markets, but also people like the IMF, the World Bank, the European Union, and things like that. So they respond to all the external actors. And I think the problem with globalization is that people have become so focused on dealing with all the external parties, all these multinational institutions, all these people who are really not the voters, that they've completely ignored the voters. And so what's happened is that you suddenly get people waking up and they suddenly realize that, oh my God, the voters have gone completely in a different direction. And whereas we still think we're pretty global and all the rest of it, the voters have had enough of it because it's just not working for them anymore.
And that would go without saying it's not working anymore. So Bob, I know you've done you know, a lot of great reports, and and I'd like to, you know, discuss part of them. And you have one of yours is macro matters stuff, and I know you did a whole series of reports in here, and I know you highlighted the financial markets and your probabilities that they go lower, right? That's your view there.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, the whole thing with financial markets is that they've kind of got you know, a lot of impetus right now because everyone's expecting this big infrastructure wave to happen. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I think, you know, if I look at both the US and the UK and even in other countries, they're all right now embracing infrastructure. So, you know, I think we've definitely been moving this shift where we're trying to go from monetary stimulus to fiscal stimulus. And so you've seen commodity prices and, you know, companies like Caterpillar and stuff, and even the banks starting to rally. But I sort of think that that's probably a little bit too early. And it's pricing a lot of stuff that I'm not necessarily sure is the same. If you look at, for example, already you've seen that with the infrastructure plan that Donald Trump's unveiling, he's talking about having the private sector coming in to fund a big part of it, and, you know, then getting tax breaks. Now, that's going to be, I think, tough because at the very least, he's going to get the Democrats against him. He's going to get people within his own sort of administration, I suspect, who may not necessarily be in the same mode. And also the reality is they're trying to get all this stuff through Parliament, through the Senate, into actual action, I think will take time. So I'm not sure. I think prices have gone ahead of themselves a bit too much. And I think also the other bigger worry to me is that if I look at every single politician out there, they're all about economic nationalism now. And that's wonderful. It sounds great. We're all going to be great again. Britain, the US, India, everyone. The only problem with economic nationalism is you're all hell-bent on being great. The rest of the world can go high. And when that happens, usually trade starts to go. And when you look at most countries, trade makes up a big chunk of their earnings.
And, of course, you know, that could be start to be an issue, and I think we're seeing a lot of changes. Now, what's your take on all these idiot protesters in the United States? What does a guy from across the pond see and think about all that?
You know, I think well, we had the same thing out here in post-Brexit, right? I mean, I think what I saw when I was actually there, of course, in the U.S. during election time, and what amazed me was that I saw much as in Britain, there was, you know, large parts of business actually went into grieving. You know, it wasn't just that they lost and they were sad. They actually went into grieving because they couldn't believe that their worldview had been rejected so soundly. I think the real problem you have is that whether it's Brexit or the US, you actually have a country that's very, very sharply divided down the middle. So either way, whichever side wins or loses, the side that lost is still a huge minority. And the other problem you have is that both sides, I'm not sure, really have the ability right now to cross that divide. You know, if I look at all the people who are protesting right now against Donald Trump, you know, you see a lot of this, you know, going back and forth in the newspapers with all these people kind of agitating and self-flagellating over this whole kind of how could this have happened and is liberalism dead and all the rest of it. The reality is liberalism, I don't know if you can call it that even, but liberalism, as it were, stopped working for a lot of people a long time ago. So you can't turn around and claim it's the best system if it doesn't work. And the fact that a lot of people felt disenfranchised by it tells you that there's a problem with at least the system you had.
So, you know, I'm in agreement with you on the way it's working. And, of course, you do have people, I can't believe the people that are crying about, you know, you named it. I mean, it's really become a very sad state of affairs, because really what you should be doing, no matter what the result was, is you should be stepping up behind, in the United States, the president now, and trying to make better for everybody, because at the end of the day, we are all people and we want to be better as people and have a better society to live in. And it shouldn't matter who is the president. At the end of the day, you have to try to make it work, because if you don't like who's in there, in 4 years you can vote that person out. So that's what I look at. But we're with my guy, Dr. Bob Swarup, who is just in Chicago, New York, all over the country, but he's one of the smartest guys we know, the author of Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts, as well as a chief economist for CamdorGlobal.com. This is the Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz. We're going to step out here for a break. Make sure you go to libertytalk.fm and download the show every single day. In the meantime, this is the Bubba Show. We're going to step out here for a break, and we will be right back after the break with more from Dr. Bob. The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz. Welcome back to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz with Dr. Bob Swarup from CamdorGlobal.com, as well as the author of Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts. You can get it on Amazon. Make sure you buy a copy. You got to help the guy out. So, Dr. Bob, we got, you mentioned it earlier, and the markets have certainly run up in the States, and actually pretty much worldwide, on this anticipation. Now, you have said to me many times before that the biggest issue in the globe is really the massive amount of debt. Now, those debt problems did not disappear just because Donald Trump got elected, right? So what's the status? And as you mentioned, they've gone way too far, in my opinion. Now, again, we can't tell you when it's going to not go higher anymore, but they're certainly anticipating, and I don't think that they can even get to where they're at now without all the problems we have. Or what do you say?
Look, I mean, the reality is the markets have basically become very, very schizophrenic. You know, the whole point is they desperately want growth on some level. They desperately want to have an ever upward path, and they just don't want to face up the reality that pretty much most asset classes are expensive now. But you look behind the scenes, there's so much weakness. I mean, you take the banks, for example. I mean, the banks are rallying as if, you know, the good days are here again, growth is there. The truth of the matter is that, you know, if I look at, say, the Green Party infrastructure plan that Donald Trump's proposing, I can already see issues because, for example, the moment he tries to put that one through, someone's going to agitate about the debt burden, someone's going to agitate about, you know, what infrastructure should be allowed and things like that. So I think that whole thing can get held up for ages. Moreover, the banks, you know, the way they've rallied makes no sense to me. I mean, you've got to remember the president is a guy who was made bankrupt six times and blackballed by all the banks. I somehow doubt that when he gets into power properly, the banks are going to be first on his list of buddies to, you know, get along with. He's coming on a very populist mandate. And at the end of the day, you know, I think a lot of what he is a showman. But yeah, I think he's also a pragmatist, and he will go where the flow is. So to my mind, he will try and do some stuff that is, within quotes, pro-growth, the way the banks might feel that they want. But more importantly, he's going to be very, very keen to please a lot of the vote banks that have brought him in. Because if he doesn't, how then does he get reelected in 4 years' time? And people forget that the window actually is very short. You know, people talk about 4 years' time. In reality, let's not forget that actually campaigning, in effect, begins in 2.5 years' time again.
Well, if I said to you that this is my opinion, okay? I think he's going to do a good job. I think he's not going to really suck up to anybody. And I think he's a one-term president by choice. And I think he's just trying to get things started in the right direction. And I don't think he's going to run again. And I think that the banks are banking on higher interest rates so they can free up some cash so they can start lending money again. What do you say to all that?
Look, I think, as I said, I think he's a pragmatist. I think he will have challenges, though, in terms of getting his agenda through, because he has a problem where there are a lot of different people who have been promised lots of different things who will all be asking for their pound of flesh. Secondly, the big difference, which I don't think he fully has appreciated, between being a businessman and being a politician, is that if you're a businessman, a company is still a pretty much medieval feudal structure. You've got a guy at the top, and the guy at the top has a lot of control over everyone below him. It's a proper pyramid, and you actually have a huge amount of control of the rank and file. In politics, it's completely inverted. You may be the guy at the top, but the base of your pyramid is extremely weak, and in fact, more than anything else, drives decisions up rather than you driving them down. So I think the politics is going to be his big challenge. And I think, going back to our earlier discussion about partisanship, the one thing that has died in the last few years on both sides is the sense of any sort of compromise. So there is going to be no real reaching out, I think, across the fence to try and make things happen by both sides. He may try, but bear in mind that there's only a limit to what he can push through by sheer of will. You know, if he can't take, for example, his party with him, the Republicans, and they already, by the way, have had huge issues with him up to now, that I can't see that just disappearing overnight. I see that dragging on in the background, because they'll be keen to cement their grip, but ultimately, as you said, probably try and replace him with someone more suitable in their mind in a term or so.
So, you know, as we over-anticipate and the banks are excited, you know, I'm a big believer, and I'd like to get your opinion here, because you are a natural economist, and you're not a true economist, because you speak different. In other words, you tell the truth the way I see it, and maybe just because you agree with me on a lot of things. But I say that most banks are in trouble still, and I would venture to bet that if you went in and actually did a true audit, they would not have enough in reserve to handle their capital requirements, but yet they still continue to operate like they do.
No, you're right. But most of them don't. I think the reality is many of them, when the last crisis happened, moved a lot of stuff onto the back book so they won't have to recognize the losses. You know, and I think the thing is that even if the banks start to lend again, you know, there's a lot of regulation out there in the background, which you can't just unwind like that. I mean, look at Basel. You know, banks, for example, if you look at what their leverage used to be back in 2007 compared to what the leverage is now, it's gone down significantly. And, you know, that may be relatively, you know, meaningless in the context of they still have enormous problems. But even if you pretended for a second they didn't have problems, just the sheer amount of lending that's been lost through that deleveraging of the bank's capital charges means that there's a huge gap already out there in the economy. I think, you know, the problem you have is that, you know, the Fed will probably raise rates in December because they feel they need to, and they've been promising it for so long. But if they don't, I think they run the risk of their guidance coming unstuck. But to me, what next year is going to be about is next year the focus is going to be about more and more of these populist revolutions. And I think until each of these countries beds down, which will almost take at least a year, you're not really going to see a sudden, you know, coordination of any sort to deal with some of the issues that lie beneath the surface, like the debt, like the banking balance sheet issues and things like that.
So, you know, Bob, we have a big talk about inflation, and, you know, there is none, they say. Now, I'm going to ask it to you this way. The average American is making less money than they made 17 years ago, yet they're paying a lot more for goods and services. And, of course, we don't count what we use every day as part of the inflationary thing because it's too volatile for them, so they don't want to count that. But how can it not be inflation when you're paying more and you're making less?
Well, I think this is what, you know, discussing before when we met, which is that, you know, I think the problem you have is that if I look at the world from a 10-year view rather than just the next year, I think over the next 10 years, you will see returns to labor start to rise at the expense of returns to capital. What I mean by that is that part of the anger that's been driving these governmental changes in country after country is the feeling that a lot of people felt that society had left them behind. You know, they felt their earnings weren't going up, but effectively their spending, their debt levels, the promises, you know, these were not really being met. And I think what many of them are now demand is a reversal. If they don't get that, by the way, immediately, with whoever they bring in, they will simply go after somebody else till they get it eventually. So I think what you will see increasingly is more wage bargaining, more demands for labor protectionism, which effectively raises wages again. And you've already seen, by the way, even within quotes, Democrat or liberal areas like New York, Airbnb running into issues around, you know, how its services are sold. I see that being the main driver now. And when you look at that, the problem is that the biggest cost of any business out there, banks, you know, widget manufacturers, submarkets, whatever, is labor. If the cost of labor starts to go up, you have a problem because either you raise your prices or you absorb that cost. If you absorb that cost, your margins go down, which means your return on capital is going down. Now, in the UK, post-Brexit, and as I see with the UK, of course, a few months ahead of the US, what you've really had is a lot of talk, but not much action last few months. But what you have seen is in supermarkets, for example, you had the most bizarre battle between Tesco, which is one of the largest supermarket chains out here, and Unilever, where Unilever wanted to raise the product of some of their stuff, sorry, the prices of some of their products, and Tesco refused to pass those prices on because they dared not raise the prices for fear of hitting sales. The whole thing ended up being a standoff where lots of Unilever products just disappeared from the supermarket shelves. It was bizarre. It was almost like being in a communist country where you actually have food disappearing from the shelves because people, you know, can't get hold of it. So, you know, I can see that happening more, by the way, in the U.S. as well, that kind of, you know, tension where, you know, manufacturer and consumer are battling over who absorbs the hit. if input starts to go up.
I think it better be the manufacturer. They make a lot of money. Anyways, this is Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global, also the author of Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts, and the author of Deglobalization and a bunch of other stuff. really smart guy. We're lucky to have him on. This is the Bubba Show, Todd Bob Horwitz. Make sure you go to libertytalk.fm and download the show every single day, as well as check out bubbatrading.com as we get ready for the new year. And we've got lots of good programs to help you hedge and get yourself ready to trade for the new year. The Bubba Show, Todd Bob Horwitz. We'll be back with Dr. Bob Swarp after the break. The Bubba Show, Todd Bob Horwitz. What's up, everybody? Bubba here. It's finally here, the long-awaited Bubba Report, bringing you news from all the trading floors across the globe. We've got Scott Cialady, the cow guy, as seen on CNBC, Fox, and Bloomberg. We've got Keith Bliss, CNBC, Fox, and a floor trader at the New York Stock Exchange. We've got The Badger, who writes the hot topics in the political news. We've got myself putting together my own unique indexes that will help you give you a better idea of what's going on in the market. All you need to do to get a hold of the Bubba Report is go to thebubbashow.org and sign up for the newsletter, or you can email me direct at bubba@thebubbashow.org. We want you to have this report because we've got over 150 years of experience talking about markets, getting ready for the trading, and puts you in the best position to have successful. So email me at bubba@thebubbashow.org to get a copy of your report, or go right to the website, thebubbashow.org. Make sure you get it. It's a must-have for every investor and trader. The Bubba Report. Todd Bubba Horwitz with Dr. Bob Swarup, Camdor Global, as well as the author of Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts, and a whole bunch of other stuff. But Dr. Bob, okay, so now you've been, for 6 or 7 months that we've talked, you've been on the debt issue, and they have to relieve debt. Do you think that is a possibility that they're going to actually forgive or relieve some of this debt? Or are we going to continue in this kind of circle that we're in, and actually just end up pushing it off to, in the United States, the taxpayers again, and kind of sticking it to them? Because that's really usually what happens, and that's why they keep looking for inflation, so they can pass off some of these costs through the economy without anybody really knowing that they're getting screwed. What's your take?
Well, I think they're going to try and socialize more and more of the debt. You know, and if you look at it this way, let's go back to the infrastructure plan again for a second. In the infrastructure plan, even if you say that the whole thing is going to be financed by the private markets, the reality is no pension plan or insurer or anyone's going to finance any kind of infrastructure unless there's a cash flow at the end of it. And so, you know, I mean, to be honest, it's no different to the government borrowing money, this time not through the treasury market, but directly from private investors, because that cash flow will still come out. Except the difference here is the government's kind of saying, well, you know what, we'll be the middleman. You guys build the infrastructure. We'll make sure the cash flow comes to you through whether it's tolls or whatever. Now, the problem you have is that, again, going to the UK, you had this fiasco a few years ago called the public-private partnerships kind of a scheme, where they tried to build a whole bunch of schools and hospitals and all these kinds of stuff with private capital. And of course, you know, because they just were naive and didn't really realize what a good return might be, they promised some pretty fancy yields to all these investors who then went and bought the stuff. And of course, next thing you knew, all these hospitals and, you know, sort of schools and stuff were finding themselves having to divert more and more money towards meeting these debt burdens, in effect, that were kind of off balance sheet. And that kind of caused a huge amount of anger. And, you know, you have to be very careful, because I think what people don't have the appetite for, and I don't understand why, in a sense, politicians keep failing to see this, a lot of the anger you have right now comes ultimately from economic reasons. You know, if you look at the Arab Spring, when that kicked off a few years ago, it was not about a yearning for democracy and freedom. I mean, that was bullshit. What it actually was about the price of food and energy becoming too high. If you look at the deglobalization wave that's right now sweeping across country after country, it is being driven by people feeling that they are no longer getting any wage growth, and they've now reached that point of being fed up with it. But equally, that sort of capacity as a society or as individuals to deal with the debt burdens or the demands that they have in terms of cash flow is getting too much. You know, look at, for example, any person who now comes in to the job market, typically they will have an enormous debt pile already from the student loans they've taken out. They then have to think about housing, which is going to be huge in itself. I mean, in this country, the average age in which somebody buys their first home has now gotten the late 30s. In Italy, it's more. You know, you don't have to think about auto cars financing. You got to buy a car, you got to finance that. You want to get healthcare. Well, guess what? There's a plan for that. Pretty much anything you want, there's an added cost of every sort. So your cash flow is just getting slowly leached away. And your sense of security with it is rapidly going as well. So the first thing you're going to do most clearly in that scenario is rebel. And the only reason is because there is just too much debt in the system and slowly leaching cash flow at many different levels. And until you fix that, the system doesn't really get better.
So, you know, you have a good feel for all this stuff. And you wrote, okay, globalization is dead and we are starting the journey back. And you're saying the world is getting smaller. What does that all mean?
Well, I think the reality is that the world is turning inwards, right? The new politics, if you want to think about it globally now, the new politics is no longer left-wing or right-wing. The new politics basically is, are you global or are you nationalist? And I think the world is definitely turning nationalist. I mean, if you look at, for example, parties like Jobbik in Hungary, which is actually a very far-right party in many ways. They're almost quasi-neo-Nazi. Economically, they've got the same policies as Syriza, who are almost neo-communist and in power in Greece. So, you know, I think and the whole sort of policy they have basically is anger against an unaccountable political elite and this notion that the political elite and the, by implication, the financial elite must be made to pay. And you know, the ordinary man must be made good. So I think there's this anger. The problem with a lot of these parties is that they come in on a wave of anger. They don't necessarily have a clear plan on how to deal with these issues. And so my suspicion is that what you will end up having is a gradual bigger and bigger set of fights, ultimately ending up in a series of trade wars, and the debt basically gets destroyed that way, as opposed to being anything structured. Now, that, unfortunately, if it ends up in that scenario, is an absolute disaster, because then what you're really doing is you're saying, well, if you know what, if you can't have it, I can't have it, then we'll just burn it down instead.
So, I mean, so with this happening, how does that affect the average guy or girl on the street? Does it have a major effect on them?
Over time, yes. I think in the initial phases, no. Because, you know, for example, if you're sitting there building a lot of infrastructure, you're reasonably insulated, right? You're providing employment, you're spending money, you're keeping the economy going. The problem becomes more that when you finish building the infrastructure, have you actually changed anything in the economy that's going to make it grow organically? You know, people love this idea. I mean, it's a very Keynesian thing, right? This idea that, come on, guys, if we were to build all this amazing infrastructure, and then you know, we're going to get growth again. I mean, that doesn't really work. In Japan, very famously in the 1990s, built what were called the bridges to nowhere, because, you know, they were just desperate trying to build with the view that that would somehow get growth going. But, you know, if you do that, if you go, sometimes you go look at China for a second. China's got ghost cities all over it because they just went on this huge orgy of building, which, don't get me wrong, gave them fantastic economic growth. But that economic growth is pretty hollow. And all it really did in the end was give them, you know, great numbers, but actually an enormous pile of debt in a population that, if anything, is even more unhappy now than it was when it started. So, you know, the U.S., by the way, has its own experience of this. And let's not forget things like the Hoover Dam and all this kind of stuff. That was all built at the end of the 1920s and 1930s, when they were dealing with the Great Depression. And, of course, back then they had the same thing, which was that, well, let's just build. Somehow, you know, this notion that Field of Dreams style, build and they shall come, that doesn't really happen. I mean, hope is not an investment strategy. Hope is not a strategy of any sort.
No, it's, come on. Hope is a strategy. Come on, Dr. Bob.
A pretty bad one.
Now, obviously, we have to have hope, but hope isn't an investment strategy. It's not a good strategy, and that is correct. But don't you think, like, for example, in infrastructure, if we rebuilt the current country that needs to be rebuilt, you know, the roads, the bridges, and the levees that need to be done, that would create some growth and create some cash flow?
Look, I think there's a lot of infrastructure that can be built, and there's a lot of infrastructure that should be built. Having said that, my worry is that if you look at the most bills that pass through any kind of parliament, there is so much bulk attached to them because different constituents fight to get projects in their particular territory because it serves, you know, their own purposes. My worry here is that $1 trillion over 10 years is not actually that much money. It sounds a big number, but really isn't that much. You then have to deal with the issue that will you find the investors who want to back it. So in this country, for example, in the UK, you've had a major issue where the government's been trying very hard to persuade the pension schemes, who of course have most of the money, to invest into infrastructure, and most of them don't want to. The reason being not that they don't want to invest in infrastructure to get long-dated cash flows, it's just they don't want the political risk. You know, what they want is they want cash flows that are existing today. So what they'll do is they'll be very happy to go buy an existing toll road. They'll be very happy to go buy an existing port, something that has cash flow today. This notion that I'm going to fund something that's going to produce cash flow for me in 5 years or 8 years or 10 years' time, that makes them nervous. Why? Because they've been burnt many times in the past with that. Secondly, their problem is they're paying pensions and they're all now starting to bleed money. They're getting cash flow negative. So the last thing they can afford to do is not have cash flow coming in. So this is the problem. I think the whole issue is a lot more complex, and people have to be very careful that, you know, it's these quick, trite answers that people throw out aren't necessarily as easy as they sound.
I understand. And again, I like to make things overly simple because, you know, that's how my mind works. It's just, you know, there's a solution. There's a problem. There's a solution. And without bringing in all of this extra work and without all bringing in all these extra people, it seems to me that we as a society, and I would say this globally, that we're always well overpaying for products and services because of the structure of the companies that are behind it all. And for some reason, we could do things a hell of a lot cheaper, a hell of a lot better, and keep people working a hell of a lot longer if we didn't build in all this crap that goes along with it. I mean, I look at a lot of these things and I say, where am I going to be when all this is done? And, I watch, because you go back and even go down to these programs that we build and we have no competition, and they somehow managed to work this out. So when we come back from the break, this is what I'm going to talk to you about, Bob. I want to know why, for example, in the insurance business, they don't allow competition from state to state. Why in other industries and cable, you know, they don't let you really compete, and yet they're worried about these monopolies. This is Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global, as well as the author of Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts. We're going to stop by here for a break. This is The Bubba Show. LibertyTalk.fm is the only network you need. Go download the show every single day. The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horst. We'll be right back with Dr. Bob after the break. The Bubba Show. Welcome back to The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horst with Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global, as well as author of Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts. And you can get that on Amazon. Make sure you check it out. We all need the money, so let's stimulate the economy and buy a book. So, Dr. Bob, okay, so in America, we've got, you know, like cable companies. Now, they don't cross lines, basically. They very rarely are in the same market. So they really kind of have price control, right? Price fix. You've got insurance companies through this Obamacare that won't go in. And in some markets, you don't have any carriers. In some markets, you have one. I want to know, why don't we have competition? And what is the problem with having competition? Because it makes products and services and prices better for everybody.
Well, I think you've hit a nail on that. So if you want to talk about what changes would create growth, I mean, two things. One is most growth of any sort, economic, political, whatever, requires diversity, right? You got people with different opinions around, you get better outcomes. Similarly, you've got a market with different players, each trying different tactics. You have choice, and people will then be able to choose what they think is the best option, whatever it might be. So I think you're right. One is that you do need to break down some of these competitive barriers, but you also need to think very hard about the role that regulation plays. You know, populations, as a general rule, tend to be a little more fond of regulation than business, for obvious reasons. And, you know, there are often all the social aspects that you have to bear in mind. But there's a lot of regulation out there that's just needlessly complex, which I think more than anything else holds things back. I mean, for example, you know, you talk about cable, that's one, but also look at all the huge amounts of issues around trying to get planning permission for pipelines and things like that. You know, the U.S. has an enormous amount of natural resources, and one of the obvious ways of getting growth is actually to take that and get it out. You know, for example, you know, you're talking about what kind of infrastructure might make growth happen. I'll give you one obvious one straight away, which is, for God's sakes, get out there and start building some liquefied gas export terminals. You know, that's a lot of money to be spent. That's pretty damn good. But more importantly, there is so much natural gas in the U.S. that is huge. There's a huge glut, which is why prices have tanked for so long. But by the way, you go across the pond to Europe, the price of natural gas is about two or three times as high. You go across the other side to Japan and China, you've again got, you know, a huge price differential. So actually what you want to do is build these export terminals and ship that gas out. Because if you can, you not only create revenues for all of that stuff, you also probably increase the price a bit, which makes producers very happy. But on the other side, for people in China or Europe or wherever, you're reducing the price of gas. So there are benefits. So you actually have a virtuous circle of growth, which benefits everyone. The only problem I have is that that involves people talking across borders and actually having global trade again. And that's my big worry. If you look at some of the stuff that comes out of Europe at the moment, where people have been talking, they've actually been, you know, talking about that if the U.S., for example, does not fulfill its obligations under the Kyoto Agreement, then actually, you know, perhaps the Europeans should introduce some sort of carbon levies on U.S. goods. So, you know, that kind of talk, unfortunately, worries me. But, you know, that kind of stuff is important. I think that some of the taxation system could be simplified a lot. I mean, you know, I've never had the pleasure of dealing with U.S. taxes, and I'm grateful, because every time I look at it, it just seems an absolute nightmare. And I don't understand why you can't just simplify it, you know, start having much simpler bans, start reducing levels of deductions, you know, remove all this alternative minimum tax crap, and actually just make it simpler. Because if you do, you actually probably free up a lot of time, which can make money.
That's only because all the crooks wouldn't get away with everything they get. They wouldn't have to. George Soros wouldn't have to pay all that money to Hillary Clinton to try to get her elected, so he could keep the same tax code in place. I mean, you know, this is, you know, these games are played. And it's really tragic when you look at, you know, these guys who, you know, the way they pay themselves. That's how they pay taxes. It becomes pretty nasty when you look at it. But I want to ask you this now as well, Dr. Bob. China, I think they're in a lot of trouble. And you mentioned earlier the hidden cities, we call them. But their currency is skyrocketing. Last I looked, either the renminbi or the yuan, whichever you want to call it. What's your take of China here now? Are they still the hot spot, or are they starting to run into some trouble again?
Well, it's interesting. You know, China has kind of fallen off the headlines the last few months between Brexit and the U.S. elections. But the problem, I think, hasn't gone away. It's just getting worse and worse. I mean, within China, you have the enormous debt burden anyway, but there isn't really a clear way of dealing with it. You know, for them to actually allow enormous waves of bankruptcies or restructurings would almost end up having to admit that the growth model they had up to now was flawed. And I think that's very hard for them. The other problem they also have is that most of the Chinese banks have been doing so much off-balance sheet lending that actually, you know, when you talk about Deutsche Bank and the rest of it being in trouble, I mean, these guys, you know, are much more opaque and probably far worse leveraged. So I think China has some issues there. And, you know, their population is also not one that can really sustain this very easily. I mean, a lot of the Chinese banks have done this because they've got an enormous pool of depositor savings, and that's what's given them the confidence to go out and lend so wildly. The fact that there's politics, because people often then want to have their prestige projects, has made it worse. The problem is the depositor base for most people is everything for them. It's their security and risk. If you look at the savings rate in China, you know, in most countries, the savings rate starts off low when you're young and becomes very high or higher when you get to your 50s and 60s. China has an unusual shape. It's got what might call a savings smile. In other words, people who are 55 and older save a lot, as you'd expect. But actually, people who are, let's say, in their 20s and early 30s save just as much, perhaps more. And the reason being because China does not have a social safety net. And that's really important. People don't perhaps appreciate that enough. Because it doesn't have a social safety net, all these young people are saving the crazy because they're in a society which is much, much more expensive for them. They also are suffering the hangover from the one-child policy where each person is now finding themselves responsible for a couple of grown-ups who are now slowly approaching retirement, and they're thinking about all the old age, health care, et cetera, the costs of that come with it. So they're not saving seriously. Now, if you suddenly start to torch their savings at any level by having a bank or two go bankrupt, then I think you've got a huge potential for populist anger that could really, take that country under.
So, as we come near the end here, Dr. Bob, I have a feeling that there's too much paper gold out there and not enough physical gold, and especially the way I see things being bought up in the physical world, but the paper world. Do I have any valid point there, or am I nuts?
No, there's always been too much paper gold versus physical gold. I mean, there was this notion people sometimes talk about that, currency is better when there's gold backing it. I mean, the problem is to go back in history, even when you had physical gold backing currency, people still did fractional reserving. And let's not forget that Germany asked the U.S. for its gold a while back and was told you'll get it back very, very slowly over the next couple of decades. So there isn't enough physical gold around. But it's interesting. People will run for it when money gets burnt. I mean, I don't know if you've been following what's happening in India. But in India, the government overnight, 2 or 3 weeks ago, actually banned higher denomination bills and replaced them with new ones. And it was their way of trying to wipe out the black economy, the cash economy, because India was huge. But what they hadn't realized was that 86% of all the currency in circulation in India was these higher denomination bills. So as a result, there's been the most enormous liquidity crunch in India, and it's playing havoc with the economy. I mean, my suspicion is that when everything is said and done, it'll take a whole percent of GDP growth for India. But what's interesting about there is that gold, of course, has suddenly emerged, as, by the way, have some cryptocurrencies, as being a place where you can kind of store your cash and at least keep it safe while you wait for this whole thing to play out. So although gold might be trading at that kind of what it's now, about $1,000, a little over that, at the moment, in India, it's been going at a premium to that of probably anywhere between 70 to 120%.
Dr. Bob Swarup, Camdor Global, Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts. Thank you so much for being here. It's always great to talk to you.
Always a pleasure, Todd. Always a pleasure.
This is The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Same time, same station. The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz. Every day, everybody. So we'll see you later. Thank you so much. Wake up, Maggie.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.